Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. What are the legal rights of journalists in war and military conflicts? And are these legal rights being upheld? Well, in some cases, yes, but in most cases, they are not. Next, our good friend Richard Ady put together a roundtable discussion with Emily Crodfer, Peter Cave, and Phoebe Wim Pope to discuss this subject.
Explosions. Gunfire.
The town has been under heavy bombardment for 2 days now.
But our convoy was hit by a roadside bomb.
The roads are covered in broken glass, tiles.
He only had a camera.
Lumps of jagged shrapnel.
Another stop, this time to refuel. Petrol stations around here are abandoned. The driver fills up the tank while smoking a cigarette and handling homemade bombs.
The guy's telling us to go inside the building because it's very dangerous here and he's asking if we want a cup of tea. I think tell him, not at the moment, thank you.
There is still a lot of fire coming at us. Some of it's exploding.
We saw in the last few moments a rocket flying over. So we're going to try and get a little bit closer to determine exactly what's going on. Let's make a run for it.
Paula Sleer reporting from the Ukraine conflict last year for Russia Today. It's easy when you watch or listen to journalists filing from the middle of something like that to forget that there are laws that govern everything going on around them, technically at least. International humanitarian law is clear on how non-combatants should be treated. Journalists aren't combatants, which ought to mean that they're protected. But as you know, that ain't necessarily so. In fact, increasingly, they're targets. So what's the law worth? Well, to answer that question, I'm joined by a panel of experts. Dr. Phoebe Wim Pope is the Director of International Humanitarian Law at the Australian Red Cross. She's worked in conflict zones throughout Africa, the Middle East and Europe. Peter Cave is a reporter's reporter. When he retired as the ABC's foreign affairs editor 3 years ago, he'd covered 60-something countries, beginning in what's now Vanuatu with the Coconut War and finishing in the Middle East. And Dr. Emily Crawford is the co-director of the Sydney Centre for International Law. She's taught and lectured both locally and overseas, including the training of military personnel on behalf of the Red Cross in Australia. Peter, I want to start with you. Does international humanitarian law actually help to protect journalists and media workers?
Well, it should. It's a great set of laws. The main problem, as I think the other panellists will agree, is the ability to enforce it and who does enforce it. The laws themselves are good. There are special laws that apply to journalists. They don't really apply to Australian journalists, the specialist ones, because we don't have a press pass issued by the government. So therefore, the laws that apply to us are the laws that apply to all civilians. But they do make it quite clear that we are civilians, and as civilians, they afford us protection.
Emily, what do you think?
I absolutely agree. I think the law is very robust. It's very clear that civilians are not to be deliberately targeted, and there are serious penalties that attach to the deliberate targeting of civilians, of which journalists clearly are. The problem is with compliance. It's a matter of whether or not the parties to the conflict actually abide by those rules. So it's not for an absence of rules, it's for an absence of compliance.
So Phoebe, it's not the law, it's the compliance. but there are legal protections, both specifically for journalists and for civilians, which journalists are. There's sort of two sorts of protections, aren't there?
Two sorts of protections. So in international armed conflict, so when we're talking about this set of laws, the international humanitarian law, it only applies in situations of armed conflict, either international armed conflict or non-international armed conflict. So, and different sets of laws apply in each of those. So in international armed conflict, if journalists are travelling with a state military, then they can be, they're considered as war correspondents. And the advantage of that is if they happen to get captured, they receive prisoner of war status.
We would think of them as embedded.
Embedded, yes.
Right.
So modern-day embedded journalists would then, if they were captured while they were travelling with the military, they would have the right to be considered prisoners of war, and with all the benefits that that has. So the Third Geneva Convention is an entire convention that outlines the protections and the rights of prisoners of war, and journalists under that sort of system would fall into that. In non-international armed conflict, journalists that are operating either as journalists or even embedded are protected as civilians and therefore are not subject to direct attack.
Right. So the laws, there, you all agree on that, but it's in the breach. So is it worth having laws that people routinely ignore?
Well, whether people routinely ignore laws and directly target journalists or whether journalists are caught in situations where they become caught up in conflict are two different questions, and they would be two different outcomes in terms of what sort of a breach of the law had occurred. I like to think about the game of footy and, imagine a game of Australian rules football with no umpire and no rules. We have rules in footy. People end up in the tribunal every Monday. And I don't mean to trivialise the laws of armed conflict for one second, but when we start to imagine a society, I lived in Somalia for 4 months where there were no rules, and that is a much more frightening paradigm than having a system of rules that don't always work.
I can only imagine, but the thing about a footy tribunal is the sanctions are real. A player can be, in some codes of football, sent off immediately, and when they front the tribunal, they can be told that they're out forever,
yep.
Perhaps. So in conflict, there's no match official, there's no video evidence, or not very often, and
well,
any
that's
punishment...
that's what journalists are there for, they're providing the video evidence.
Yeah.
But the punishment is so far removed from the actual deed that it seems it doesn't have the same meaning as if a footballer does the wrong thing. I mean...
Well, it's not immediate, that's true. And I think that the enforcement mechanisms are very difficult in the IHL system. We now have the International Criminal Court, which is the first criminal tribunal for the prosecution of war crimes, first permanent tribunal for the prosecution of war crimes. And there have been other tribunals before for the former Yugoslavia, for Rwanda, for a mixed tribunal in Sierra Leone, Cambodia. So there have been a series of these. They are slow, there is no question, and they are far removed from the day-to-day conflict.
Mm. Peter, I suppose the question is it getting more dangerous for journalists? What's with your frame of reference? The numbers seem to suggest that it is, that journalists are being targeted.
I think it started to change in the former Yugoslavia. I think that, the Serb side started to think that maybe most of the journalists were on the other side, so they started targeting journalists. I think what's happened since then is that there's been a growth in social media, the ability of terrorist groups in particular, but also government and semi-government groups to get their information out other than through the correspondents on the ground. And in a way, if you're a terrorist or you want to make a point, you can target a journalist. The news will still get out. The pictures will still be available on social media. You may even get a little bit more publicity.
It becomes
by
a thing in
journalists. I remember, I know journalists who worked in Vietnam, and they said, well, Charlie didn't target us because Charlie knew that they needed us to get their message out. Well, that doesn't exist, and that hasn't existed certainly for the last few years.
Well, it's now in Syria and Iraq, journalists are definitely targeted. The so-called Islamic State has made propaganda out of murdering them on camera.
It's a great way to get publicity. I think also there is also an element that a lot of these groups know that the journalists can be a source of funds. They can try the kidnapping route. Mm. They can, they know that a lot of journalists do have kidnap insurance. They can get $500,000, $1 million, $2 million out of a big media company, so they're quite happy to target the journalists. If that doesn't work, they don't get their money, they can then put the journalist in front of a camera, and they know they will get massive publicity.
That's right. Okay, well, let's talk about practical measures to ensure the law is, well, to try and encourage the law to be more applied and have some meaning, because this is real. As we speak, 82 journalists have been killed this year in conflict. It was 138 last year. Emily, there is this thing called the Press Emblem Campaign. Just explain it for us.
Okay, so about 11 years ago now, in 2004, a non-governmental organisation called the Press Emblem Campaign drafted a draft covenant for the protection of journalists, which was meant to be a standalone piece of international law to be adopted by states, in which they outlined all of the protections that journalists should be afforded, similar to what's outlined in Additional Protocol 1, Article 79, and in Geneva Convention 3, Article 4, basically restating that journalists are civilians, they should have certain protections, etc. But one of the key elements of the draft covenant was the idea that there should be a press emblem. So drawing on the existing protected emblems under international law, like the Red Cross and the Red Crescent, the Press Emblem Campaign thought it would be better if journalists working in situations of violence and armed conflict should wear an emblem that was identifiable as at a distance, marking them out as being press and so therefore immune from attack. And the emblem was has been designed as being a large orange circle with the word press written in white through the centre.
Black. It's black.
It's been changed to black, has it? Okay,
I think
right.
So. It's a very literal kind of emblem, it has to be said. It's
well, the idea was that it was not using any of the currently kind of protected emblem colours, which for the Red Cross is, of course, red, for cultural property is blue. So it was going to be recognisable at a distance and able to mark out a journalist as being specially protected. And you can see some of the rationale behind this, perhaps in situations where journalists are being accidentally targeted, where they might be carrying equipment that could, say, from a helicopter gunship, be mistaken as being a rocket launcher. There is a famous example from 2007 of some Reuters journalists who were targeted because the Americans who were flying overhead in their Apache helicopters mistook their tripods and their cameras as being rocket launchers, and they fired on them believing that they were actually Iraqi insurgents. So you can understand some of the rationale perhaps in that case is saying, well, if they were wearing a big emblem saying we're press, someone who was perhaps looking at them through the lens of a drone might think twice and say, oh, no, they're actually civilians, we don't target them. But from my research and certainly from interviews with journalists, that wouldn't necessarily seem to solve the problem of journalists who are being deliberately targeted because they're press. And in fact, the overwhelming response seems to be, well, we may as well just be wearing a bullseye. That would make things much easier for the other side, because if we're going around showing ourselves to be journalists with a really big sign that says press, it just seems to be a way of actually identifying ourselves to the other side as being targets.
Emily, this is really underlines the new importance of social media, which has really changed things, especially in conflict reporting. But what about if we look at it from another angle? Can social media be used to get greater compliance with the laws of war?
I think so. I think there is an immediacy to it that allows for public censure, for bringing certain issues to the attention of governments that perhaps may not have gotten out as easily. I think there is certainly evidence coming out of Syria that Syria and Iraq, that there is much more information coming out about the acts that are taking place there that may not have happened 10, 20, 30 years ago. So I think there is a potential for more compliance, but that is then also dependent on whether or not the people committing the atrocities or committing the war crimes actually care about whether or not they've been shown to the world as having committed war crimes. I think we've seen with Daesh or Islamic State or whatever name you want to call them, they don't care that people know that they are beheading. In fact, they revel in people knowing that they are beheading civilians and engage in what we would consider to be and what are war crimes and crimes against humanity. So it really does. It's a complicated relationship. Not only do you have to be reporting that these things are happening, but people have to be concerned about being found out.
Yes.
There's also a question of verifying that stuff. I mean, there was a video going around in the early days of Syria of allegedly government troops cutting people's heads off with a chainsaw, which, when it was investigated properly, turned out to be old footage of a Mexican drug lord beheading people. There have been numerous examples of false videos, you know, videos being manufactured by the Syrian government, being manufactured by people who've got a barrow to push. I mean, the warring factions are not stupid. You know, they are able to manufacture propaganda and put it out on social media, and that stuff really has got to be verified. You can't accept it. I mean, a lot of people don't trust journalists, but I think, you know, if it comes from a recognised journalist, someone who works for a recognised organisation, it's probably got a little bit more credibility than something that simply just pops up on the internet. And there are also journalists, you know, who spend a lot of time at the ABC. We had two very good journalists in the Radio Current Affairs Department who would spend weeks checking and verifying, making contact through social media with people who are putting things out and asking them questions about what they were doing. That process of verification is what real journalism's about.
And I'm happy to name check them. They're Jess Hill and Connie Agius.
Indeed.
And they're both terrific journalists. All right, well, let's talk now a bit about what can be done. I think I've started saying that before, but I'm going to continue. One of the things that is being done, or has been done, is that the UN now has an International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists. It's the 2nd of November, and the date was chosen to commemorate the assassination of two French journalists in Mali in 2013. Emily, is it having any impact at all, having this particular day?
I would have to say I don't know, simply because we do tend to have lots of international days of. I mean, I unfortunately suspect that International Talk Like a Pirate Day probably gets more attention.
It would get way more attention.
than the International Day for Ending Impunity.
You can see why, though. Just think about it. It's much more interesting to the media.
That's much
the
more.
Most media people don't know there's an International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists.
It's much more upbeat, talking like a pirate rather than talking about violence against journalists. But I think what happens is where the success is happening is really behind the scenes. And that's the stuff that tends to go unreported. All of the work that's being done by organisations like the International Committee of the Red Cross, like Reporters Without Borders, and the Press Emblem Campaign, and all of these kinds of organisations, the International
Committee to Protect Journalists.
The International Committee to Protect Journalists, who are actually working to try and disseminate information about the rules to make sure that journalists are aware of the dangers in certain situations, and certainly with things like the hotline that has been set up by the International Committee of the Red Cross, which can provide instant advice and assistance to journalists who find themselves in trouble in war zones and in other situations of violence. I think it is that kind of behind-the-scenes work that is probably having more of an impact than just having one kind of designated day.
Mm. Phoebe, that hotline...
Yeah.
There have been Australian journalists who've used it, haven't there?
There have been Australian journalists that have used it. So in 2003, the ICRC office in Sulaimania was called, and there were two ABC journalists who had been attacked in northern Iraq, and they were Eric Campbell and Paul Moran, and unfortunately Paul was killed in that attack. And the ICRC helped evacuate those two journalists out to the Australian Embassy in Iran. So that's a service that the ICRC does provide to journalists, people who go missing, people who are wounded or attacked, but also people who might be imprisoned, and the ICRC tries to track them down, work out where they are, make contact with authorities, and provide a bridge between the journalists who might be imprisoned and their families through Red Cross messages.
Peter, what else would help, do you think? What would make doing this job a safer thing to do?
I think it would be good if the ICRC were able to be more vocal in condemning attacks. It would be good if the enforcement of international humanitarian law wasn't sort of in the hands of the Treaty of Rome and the various strictures that they have on going ahead with prosecutions for the International Tribunal. It would be good if an international tribunal were the first port of call for someone who's committed an act against the international humanitarian law, rather than having the countries themselves deal with it. I don't think that always works very well.
All right. That's where we might pause. to have questions from the audience. So if you've got one, get your hand up.
Thank you very much for those insights. The discussion has focused a little bit on the enforcing of the laws rather than the laws themselves. What role do you think long-term prosecution of events against journalists plays? So being prepared to invest and track over decades to hold people to account.
If I could jump in there, I just think if it's long-term, it's not going to work. It's got to be fairly immediate. It's got to be within the... you know, the immediate memory of the atrocity. Otherwise, it's just too far away. You know, other things will happen. I mean, there is an international tribunal. I think we need to work on strengthening the tribunal, on making sure that there are consequences of breaking international laws. And I just don't think at the moment that the people who are breaking those laws are aware or worried about consequences.
I think it also depends on how you conceptualise the idea of consequences for your actions. If the way you visualise consequences for actions, you know, for violence against journalists, is that the perpetrators get put in jail, well, that's a very kind of particular and limited idea of viewing it. But if you broaden it and think about it in the context of maybe being held publicly accountable, that the history books record that certain persons committed these acts of violence, that might be another way of conceptualising it. And I think about this specifically in the context of the murder of the Balibo 5 journalists and of Roger East. I think that at the time there was a massive cover-up. There was no thought ever that there was ever going to be any kind of public accountability for what took place. Now, that was now nearly 40 years ago. And through the kind of dogged activities by family members of the journalists and by academics and by members of civil society, we are now at the point where that got taken before the New South Wales coroner. And there is general public acceptance that the Indonesian military deliberately killed those men. And so that's a different form of accountability. Now, unfortunately, none of those people are ever going to go to jail. The coroner's court said that there were grounds for prosecuting, but due to issues with regards to state immunity and also Australia's political relationship with Indonesia, we're not actually going to see any of these people actually brought before the International Criminal Court or before the Australian courts. But I think you would be hard-pressed in most parts of the world to maintain the idea that these people were just caught in crossfire. So that's a different form of accountability. It may not necessarily be as kind of primal as having these people being thrown in jail, but it's a different kind of accountability.
Do we have another question?
It's a question for Peter, but I'd be interested to know what the rest of the panel would think too. Peter, you said that the reason that Australian journalists don't get the special protection is that the Australian government doesn't issue them with a journalist credential, if I've understood that right. Would it be better if the government did?
It's a technicality. Talks have been going on for some time. You know, there's been a bit of to and fro between the unions and the government over a number of years. The ICRC got slightly involved at one stage, I think. The only thing that we have ever really had is the official visits pass, and there was some to and fro as to whether that was an official accreditation. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I've got two lawyers beside me, but I suspect that that wouldn't fulfil the requirement under the protocols that relate to journalists of being an official government press pass.
I'm not sure. I mean, the rules in the Geneva Conventions talk about being accredited by the armed forces that you accompany. So I imagine that any journalist who actually is properly embedded would have some documentation that would signal them out as being officially with...
Never in cases when I've been embedded.
Okay, well, then the only thing I could imagine would be that in a situation of possibly being captured, and Phoebe, if you can help me out with this, there would be some process of verification, surely, with the armed forces that this was actually someone who was accompanying them.
As I said, it's a bit technical, but my understanding is that it quite specifically has to be a press pass issued not by the military but by the government of the country.
To be fair, Peter, that documentation of yours could still be grinding its way through the Defence Department.
Could well be. Yeah.
And any day you may, in fact, get accreditation. So.
Well, I got an accreditation in Egypt recently.
Well, that's where we'll leave it. I think I'm somewhat clearer on what is a really complex situation. What remains, I think, deeply concerning is that bloggers and citizen journalists and social media, notwithstanding, news still happens where journalists are. So a story is much more likely to be reported, to gain a wider currency, to have an impact if a journalist is there to do it. And in places like Syria and Iraq, parts of Africa, Afghanistan, much of Pakistan, southern Philippines, and in other places too, it's too dangerous for journalists to work, which means that there are crimes and there are atrocities that are going unwitnessed and unreported. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking our panel. Wait until I give you all the names before the deafening roar. Phoebe Wynne-Pope, Peter Cave and Emily Crawford.
Well, thank you very much, Richard, for that roundtable discussion. Well, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation and what we can expect and what's been happening over the past 7 days. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through August 15th. Normal at low and middle latitudes. Normal to fair at high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through August 15th, magnetic conditions quiet, shortwave fade-outs unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through August 16th, solar activity low with a slight chance for M-class activity. Geomagnetic field unsettled or perhaps active by late on the 16th. From Peter Coleman in Prague, geomagnetic field will be quiet on August 14th and 15th. Quiet to unsettled August 16th, 17th, 19th to 22nd, 24th, 29th and 30th. Quiet to active on August 18th, 25th, 26th, 28th and September 2nd. Mostly quiet on August 23rd, 31st and September 1st. Active to disturbed on August 27th. The outlook from SWPC in Boulder. Geomagnetic field expected to be at G1 minor geomagnetic storm levels on September 3rd and 5th, with A and K indices peaking at 22 and 5. Active levels expected August 17th, 23rd, 27th, and September 2nd, with A and K indices of 12 and 4. The lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 on August 13th to 16th, 25th, 26th, 30th, 31st, and September 1st. Solar flux dropping way down to 89 on August 18th and 19th, ascending to a peak of 122 on September 2nd and 3rd. Bill Hepburn's VHF-UHF-DX maps call for extreme tropospheric ducting around the Arabian Peninsula and the Caspian Sea all week. Also off Baja California, extending up to San Francisco by Sunday the 16th.
And that's all we have time for. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. This is Keith Perron on behalf of the whole team, 73 and 88 to the ladies.